Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. On this show, I will be highlighting two very special events that happen every summer in northwest Michigan: the Stone Circle Poetry Gatherings and the performances of the Riverside Shakespeare Company. Then Carrie Noga will tell us about the re-release of her novel, Sparrow Migrations. At the end, Fleeta Brown will be here with an audio essay on poet Margaret Gibson. It is with pleasure that I welcome poet Terry Wooten to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome, Terry Wooten.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Today we'll be talking about this summer's events at Stone Circle, and we'll also be talking about Terry Wooten's new book. So, Terry, Stone Circle, how did this all come about, and what is it?
You know, I've been asked that so many times, I've made up different stories. But I married into a farming family, an orchard farming family, and they had, you know, tractors that they carried cherry tanks with, and there were a lot of boulders around and old fence lines and piles, and I've always been fascinated by a primitive ritual of focus in stone circles or cave paintings, and I had the ability to make a stone circle and the equipment, and so I did. I wanted to create a place that where the words were the focus, the words were the center. So many times you go to an open mic, something, and there'll be either a poet on stage or a song singer, and a lot of people in the place aren't listening. So I wanted to create this focus with this stone circle, and then you put the fire in the middle. And fire is an old story, as Gary Snyder says. It's in our DNA. You can't sit around a fire and not want to hear stories or songs. And so, and then with the stone circle, there's 88 boulders and three concentric rings. It adds a kind of a mystery or a feeling of awe to it. And it's a perfect focus for, I call, communication, because poetry is intensified language. So you put the fire in a stone circle, and with a circle there's no beginning or end, no first or last, and then you put the poetry in there or song, and you've got a very, very strong recipe for communication.
And this really goes back for centuries, doesn't it? The idea of the stone circle or Stonehenge or a structure like that, and the bard telling the legends of his people.
I don't know how far it goes back. My intuition is it goes back maybe 30, 40,000 years, long before there was, you know, TV or radio. It's also how the news was passed, you know. The storytellers or the bards would take a poem or a narrative about some event that happened, they'd take it to different places, and that's how things were passed around. Ezra Pound said, good poetry is news that stays news. And I always liked that. One time I was in Cadillac High School, and I was reciting a poem about a football player, a friend of mine, who was killed in a car accident on New Year's Eve in 1966. And there were some girls up in the audience in this part of the auditorium who started kind of chattering like young girls are known to do. And I stopped after I was done the poem and asked the girls what was going on. And one of the girls was my friend's youngest brother's youngest daughter. And she knew that her uncle Larry Munn, had been killed in a car wreck when he was 17, but she'd never heard the story. And that instant I realized, hey, Pound's right, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a good poem, and it's news, it stays news.
So where exactly is Stone Circle?
Stone Circle is 10 miles north of the light in Elk Rapids. Or if you're coming from the North Petoskey, Charlevoix area, when you get to Eastport, which is just a little grocery store and a motel and a gas station, they're 5 miles south of that. So either 10 miles north of Elk Rapids, off 31, or 5 miles south of Eastport, off 31. There's a gravel road called Stone Circle Drive, and you turn up that road to the east, and you get to the top of the hill, and you'll see boulders and a mound, and you go down around behind the house, follow the arrows, and you'll see many, many more boulders. So it's real special. I enjoy having it in my backyard.
So when does this happen?
Every Saturday night during the summer. Usually we start the closest summer to the summer's, so closest Saturday to the summer solstice. This year, we're starting a week late. We're starting June 27th because of all the construction in Petoskey and Traverse City. And Labor Day comes a little late this year, too, so we just backed it up a week.
So if I am a newcomer to Stone Circle, what can I expect to see?
Well,
can you describe the scene for us?
You know, sometimes people are a little afraid of it. It's a real, you know, visually powerful thing. You know, I take it for granted. I'm used to it. But you come by our house and you go through two pear trees and sit like a two-track road. It's a big meadow, and you'll see big boulders. You know, and basically, you won't see the whole circle at first, and then. You'll go through the entrance. I had to put a little bit of fence around it because a lot of people were sneaking as far as they could away from the donation can, you know. And you walk in there. If you get there around 8, 8:30, we start at 9-ish. There'll be people in lawn chairs, people spreading blankets around. There'll be kids running from stone to stone, which I try to discourage, but it, you know, they see those stones, they want to see how many they can jump and jump and jump and jump from one to the other. Earlier in this summer, you know, as it gets dark, the fireflies will be out. Sometimes you hear coyotes later at night. That's probably the only place in a poultry gathering in Michigan where you can hear maybe frogs and coyotes.
So you've been practicing as a bard, an oral poet, for many years.
I started around memorizing poetry in 1980. I was very influenced by another Michigan poet, Max Ellison, who passed away in 85. Max just blew me away when I met him. I'd been writing for 25 years, but I was struggling, you know, like a lot of poets do. I wasn't making much of an income. And within a week after meeting Max, I started memorizing poetry, and I had like 20-some poems memorized within a week. And I've been memorizing ever since, and then going over the old ones. They're all filed alphabetically and chronologically in my head so I can keep track of them at all times. I have 563 poems committed to memory.
Wow.
It's become a lifestyle. You know, my wife is used to me walking around the house mumbling to myself, or I can walk up and down the two-track road to Stone Circle and back and practice.
Could you give us one or two to help us get the sound of the place?
The last poem in the book is from my Elders Project. It won the State History Award in Michigan a couple years ago for one of the most outstanding educational programs. And what we do is we bring elders of communities into schools, and I teach kids how to interview them. And then they write a poem or two from the elders' words, and then I write around the kids. And one of the elders in Elk Rapids was a lady by the name of Julia Pasco. And Julia, when she was 6 years old, she died at 92. Her daddy built the house my wife and I live in. And Stone Circle was her daddy's cornfield. And in this poem, which I wrote after the kids had written theirs, she talks about visiting Stone Circle. And in her 70s, it's called Epiphany. So it's my poem, Julia Pascal's words. The first time I visited Stone Circle, I had an epiphany. I can get excited about this. The place was a lot like when I was a little girl, except the stones weren't there. It was a cornfield. I got out of the car and looked around. It was like I was 8 years old again. I walked on that road that heads south. As little kids, it was a footpath through the woods and fields. A little creek runs behind Stone Circle. That's the way we used to go to visit Uncle Will and Aunt Eva. Will McLaughlin had big workhorses. They'd see us and get excited and run. I was deathly afraid of them. 70 years later, walking down that road, I could hear those horses running. It was an outstanding experience.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe you'd like to do the first poem in the book.
The first poem in the book is a special poem for me. My mother died 3 years ago from Alzheimer's. And one of the stories she would tell a lot near the end was about her pet fox. And I wrote this poem from a recording I did for my mom. Cubby the Fox. I own an old black and white photograph of a red fox standing in high grass beside my 10-year-old mother-to-be. She's wearing a white dress, kneeling and holding a thin leash or long stem. The fox is leaning and looking away. I can see love in Mom's young girl body. An uncle gave her the kit after he found a den littered with chicken and other domestic bones and killed the wild mother. The pet fox had his own coop and freedom but liked to run inside the house. Once he ran away with a fairy fox lady for 3 days and nights. Mom was heartbroken. Riding around with her parents in the car, searching ghost towns, gravel pits, and two-track roads, the family spotted a fox loitering alone in a field. I imagine him haggard and forlorn, like the knight waking from the Lady of the Mead spell in John Keats' poem La Belle Dame Sans Merci. They stopped the car. Mom slid out and called his name. The fox ran over and jumped into the back seat beside her. He rode back to their house and lived happily ever after as a wild fox can. He was Mom's first son.
It's a great piece of work. Thank you. If someone is coming to Stone Circle and wants to participate and they've never done any oral presentation, what counsel do you have for them? I mean, I imagine most people come and listen the first time, and then if they come back, they probably want to present, or some of them will.
Anyway. Yeah, a lot of people catch the bug like that. Then some people, you know, the word's gotten around. A lot of people downstate know of us. Sometimes they'll call, you know, ahead of time, maybe a month or a week or a couple days ahead of time, and want to know if they have to sign a list, get on, and no, you just show up. Sometimes they'll come and they didn't realize that it was supposed to be memorized. And if it's a small audience, I will break the rules and let them read. Especially if it's a child and they've come with a poem to read for grandpa and grandma or mom and dad, you know.
Yeah.
Rules can do more harm in a case like that. But if it's a veteran, somebody knows, I'm a little more strict with them. I've had a few problems over the years with people who they don't like the fact that they can't use the big, bad swear words. And they think I'm censoring them, censoring their art. But Stone Circle, I guess it depends on the night, but we draw a very eclectic audience, you know, families with kids, little kids, teenagers, elders, and use a little common sense, you know.
Mm-hmm. And they should do some rehearsal. Because this is a performance.
One of the biggest mistakes people make is they'll try to memorize a poem the day before.
Yes.
It doesn't stick like that very well. You should work on the poem maybe a month ahead of time or at least a week or so and practice. When I memorize a poem, I carry the poem around on a sheet of paper, and it's always in my back pocket, and I pull it out, and I'll memorize two or three lines per day, and then a lot of times I'll wake up in the middle of the night, and while I'm falling back to sleep, instead of count sheep, I'll recite the lines, and then you add more lines to that, and you recite those the next night. And again, when you get 563 poems committed to memory, it's a lifestyle. you got to constantly go polish up the old ones.
Exactly. You're filling up the hard drive.
So, yeah.
So the book, your new book, The Stone Circle Poems, which came out this spring, is a collection of poems. It probably is only a small portion of the poems you've written, though, even though it covers almost 300 pages.
Yeah, my publisher calls it my magnum opus. I'm a little uncomfortable with that because there are quite a few poems I would have liked to have included. I would have liked to have seen the whole book Lifelines included. A Child of War, which I wrote through a little girl's voice. A little girl who spent her first 5.5 years in the Netherlands under Nazi occupation. I would have liked to included more of those poems. But at the same time, I'm real happy with the poems that are included. So many of those poems had been in limited edition chapbooks.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the one I wrote about my friend's death when I was in high school, Undefeated, it had been out of print for quite a while now. And so with the chance to go back and collect all those poems and various chapbooks and put them all together in almost an autobiographical way.
Yeah, it sort of follows the chronology of your life from sort of your earliest memories to the present. Well, it's a wonderful collection, The Stone Circle Poems. Where is this available?
It's available at all the bookstores in Traverse City. Most of them are Landmark Books, Horizon, Brilliant Books. You can get it on Amazon.com. You can order it through Parker's Brothers Publishers. You can order it through me.
Okay, and we need to tell listeners how they can get to you. Your website is
Terry, T-E-R-R-Y, dash, Wooten, W-O-O-T-E-N.com.
And I want to remind listeners that the Gathering at Stone Circle takes place on
every Saturday through the summer. And we start around 9-ish, and we go till 11-ish, and we take a break. And if there's a good crowd, sometimes we go for another hour. When in the younger days, we were known to go to 2 o'clock in the morning, but we don't go that late usually anymore, probably about 12, 12:30.
And if people want to see what that looks like, on your website, there is a terrific piece of video that actually shows about 10 minutes of the activities at Stone Circle. Terry Wooten, this has really been a pleasure for me. Congratulations on your new book.
Thank you.
Congratulations on making a living as a poet, and you have done a tremendous service to this region with your Stone Circle gatherings. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me, and I appreciate it.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. If you live in the Traverse City area or are a visitor to this area, one of the special events in the summer are the performances of the Riverside Shakespeare Company. And Jill Beauchamp is here today to talk about this year's production. Welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us, first of all, about the Riverside Shakespeare Company. How many years? I know it's been around a while.
This will be our 16th summer. In 2000, a friend of mine, Brian Dungeon, who's very active at the Old Town Playhouse, had this brainstorm and met with me and said, gee, don't you think Hannah Park would be a great amphitheater-type setting to do Shakespeare in the park? And we kind of built from there. Our first few summers, we did 4 performances, a Saturday, Sunday, and we did them at noon. Found out that was very hot. So the next year we moved it back to 2. I think it took us a few years to finally figure out that we need to do it in the early evening. So all of our Saturday and Sunday performances are at 6 p.m. And if we perform, which eventually we started expanding, when we perform on a weeknight like a Friday or a Thursday, we perform at 7 p.m. just because half of our cast works till 5 and needs time to get where we're going. So we just started pretty small And now we do 9 performances. We did that last summer. We're doing 9 this summer. So we've just gradually built up. What we do now is our first weekend, we go on the road. And we learned that because that first weekend is when Father Fred motorcycles run up and down Union Street, and it's really hard to compete with motorcycles. And you can stop, but if you're having to stop every 2 minutes for a motorcycle to zoom by, it really ruins the whole thing. So we take it on the road, and then our second weekend of performances, we're at Hannah Park, which is, we kind of think of as our home base.
Okay, so Hannah Park, if people are unfamiliar with the area, is behind the old...
what we call the old library, but that's been a lot of years now.
Yes.
So 6th and Union, and it's best to go onto 6th Street and find parking. Right at the corner of 6th and Union right now, they are putting up a statue to Perry Hanna.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be done by the end of the month. So that will be up for people's viewing pleasure, too, when they come to see our performance this year.
And this year's production is?
We are doing Measure for Measure, which a lot of people say, oh, that's Shakespeare? Yeah, it's one of his problem comedies.
It's one of his dark comedies.
Right, because the main theme is really about power and what happens when you give someone power, the corruption of a person. And then there's a lot of sex wrapped up in it. The person who is given power, who's been thought to be so virtuous and wonderful, decides that he wants this nun to sleep with him. And if she will, then he'll spare her brother, who's supposed to be put to death. That's pretty dark. That's mm-hmm. not very funny. But there are tons of funny characters around all of that. So it is a comedy.
And when you take it on the road, this is just wonderful. What you do for this region, you'll be almost everywhere.
Right.
So this year's performances of the Riverside Shakespeare Company will be?
Well, we start out in Glen Arbor. This is our second year in Glen Arbor, performing in Glen Arbor. That's Wednesday, July 15th at the Studio Stage, which is behind the Lake Street Studio there in Glen Arbor, because it's a weeknight at 7 p.m. Glen Arbor is great, very artsy community. They just have been so welcoming to us. Then Thursday, July 16th, we perform in Leland, outside at the old Arts Building. This will be our 4th year there. And again, it's a 7 p.m. performance. Friday, July 17th, we perform at Waterwheel Park in Sutton's Bay, again at 7 p.m. And I think it's our 8th or 9th year at Sutton's Bay. We've been doing that quite a while. Then Saturday, July 18th, we go to Elk Rapids in Memorial Park, which is right on the main drag there. And that's at 6 p.m. because it's a Saturday. We've been performing there quite a few years. This is probably our 6th year at Elk Rapids. And then Sunday, July 19th, back to Leelanau County at Hazarot Park in Northport at 6 p.m. And this will only be our 2nd year at Northport also. We had a great audience last year for our first one. They're very receptive to us too. So then our second weekend, we come home to what we consider our home base, which is Hannah Park, 6th and Union. And we perform Thursday and Friday, July 23rd and 24th at 7 p.m. at Hannah Park. And then Saturday and Sunday, July 25th and 26th at 6 p.m. at Hannah Park.
So those are all terrific venues and beautifully display our region. And what a great place to do Shakespeare. The play?
Measure for Measure. A dark comedy.
A dark comedy, the company, the Riverside Shakespeare Company. People, if they need to go and find these dates and times, they...
We have a Facebook page, Riverside Shakespeare LLC, and the dates and times are all on there. And I'm going to do what you suggested, put it up as our cover photo, or our cover image, so that people can find it always.
Well, Jill Beauchamp, thank you for the wonderful work you do. And the admission cost...
Well, it's free. We do take donations, but we want everyone to come and not stay away because of money. So it's free.
Great. A lot of great evenings of Shakespeare. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
delighted to welcome Carrie Noga to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you, Aaron.
Carrie has been a professional writer for more than 20 years, working as a journalist for many years, and now as a public relations specialist at Northwestern Michigan College. She and her family live in the Traverse City area. Carrie, when you were last here, about 2 years ago, we were talking about your first work of fiction, Sparrow Migrations. Carrie, you self-published Sparrow Migrations, and now it has been picked up by a commercial publisher. This never happens. Could you tell us the story?
Sure, happy to. You're right. It is a little bit of a fairy tale come true, but I actually call it smart luck. The way that happened, there certainly was an element of luck because there's so many books out there. But the smart piece of it was the way that I think that I went about my self-publication process. I self-published it in April 2013 as both a paperback and a Kindle edition, and I had the most success with the Kindle edition. And what I did promotions with it. I entered the book in something called KDP Select, Amazon's Kindle Direct Publishing, which requires you to only make that ebook edition available on Amazon, no other retailers. But in turn, you can run certain specials every 3 months. They're most best known for the free books that you can do. You can lesser known is the what they call Kindle Countdown deals. And that's what I did in September of last year, in September of 2014. So I was a little bit more than a year behind me. And I did this.
Well, let's talk a second about what is a Kindle Countdown, in case some of the listeners haven't done that.
Sure. A Kindle Countdown is where you can lower your price incrementally for a defined period of time. I think I did it for a week. And my normal price, Kindle price, is $3.99. But when you have it for a countdown, you lower it to 99 cents, say, for 2 days. Then you raise it to $1.99 for 2 days, then $2.99 for 2 days, and then back to your regular price. And there's a little clock. You know, it actually does count down how much time is left on your price promotion. And I advertised it. That's the key. I advertised the lowest price when I was at 99 cents on a site called BookBub. And BookBub is an email subscription service for readers. You can sign up for specials in ebooks of virtually any genre: romance, mystery, gothic, memoir, nonfiction, cookbooks. You say, these are the kind of books I want. These are my preferences. And BookBub will send you a daily email with all these special low prices that authors have advertised. And so I did. I advertised my 99-cent special to literary fiction readers, those who had identified that preference to BookBub. And it was the first week of September. And you do get a lot of downloads. I had done it before with a giveaway, and I tried it with the countdown in September, and I got, you know, maybe 1,100 downloads or so that day. And that pushes your book up Amazon's rankings. And it starts seeing the computers there, the algorithms start seeing, wow, this book is moving. This is something we should push it out more. You know, people are engaging with this book. Let's get more engagement. And so what the acquisitions editor told me is that it popped up on her page and is recommended for you. She'd read other books that were similar to mine, contemporary fiction, literary fiction, maybe women's fiction, and she should give it a try. And at 99 cents, she did.
Bravo.
Thank you. Thank you. And so then she read it and liked it. And then the special, the countdown was in early September. And in mid-October, I got an email saying that she was interested in acquiring the rights to re-release it. And would I be interested in talking? And I ran upstairs squealing, I think. But I did. It was a Friday afternoon, and I did wait until Monday. You know, mm-hmm. So I wouldn't seem too eager. And then I got back with her Monday and said, yes, I'd like to talk to you.
What's the difference between self-publishing and having it published by a division of Amazon? How does this work for the writer?
Sure. Well, when you are self-publishing, the work is all on you. You are taking advantage of the Amazon channels, say, selling it on their site, but you are still selling it. With the current contract that I have with Amazon Publishing, they will be selling it. So the contract is very similar to if I was with a Random House or a Macmillan or anything like that. You know, they have purchased the rights to sell the book. And so now they will take charge of the physical files and putting them up on Amazon, of course, and getting paperback books into libraries and bookstores. And it'll be a royalty arrangement, similar as with any traditionally published author. And the advantage to me is I have Amazon's marketing muscle behind me. Now they know, they are the puppeteer controlling the strings on who gets that recommendation about you might like. And they have they have skin in the game on my book now. And so they want other people to like my book. So that's the advantage to me as a writer.
And I notice also it is a Kindle book and an audio book. So they take care of all of that for you?
Yes, they took care of everything. We got the contract signed in November. It was also very quick. And that was another attraction to me as a writer. When we first talked, she proposed having this ready to go in May. It was 6 months. And that's just unheard of, turnaround to a finished book in May. And they did go take one extra month because we're doing it in June now. They sent it to a studio in Grand Haven, Michigan, of all places, called Brilliance Audio, who hired the voice talent and took care of all that. I did get to record my own acknowledgments. I wanted to try my hand at that since I have done a little radio in the past, and they said sure. So they've been open to whatever suggestions and input I've offered, which has been great. And they got the new cover designer. All the steps that you would traditionally follow, they have taken care of.
Okay, and originally you had 100% control of your work, which is always very nice. But now you have to have editors and designers mm-hmm. and people who guiding you on what you should do. What was that experience like?
In general, it was really positive. They also said that this is your book, and if you don't want to do something, you are at the helm. You can say yay or nay to any particular changes. And I talked with a few other authors before I agreed to do this. I asked for a few reference names, and they corroborated that. One person said, yes, I did everything they suggested. One person said, nah, I didn't think much, and they were fine with that too. I was really pleased with the developmental editor that I was matched with, who read the whole book and made very high-level suggestions. And I feel that she really improved the book. I do like the new cover. I was given four choices of covers to start with. One was a modification on my original. And I had an attachment to the original, but I will say that I think that the new cover, which has a very large font for the title, has an appeal that will certainly translate well in the digital format. Since a lot of people are going to see this in a thumbnail on Amazon, this new cover, I mean, it's you're going to see it. You're definitely going to see it even in a thumbnail format.
And most independent authors wouldn't know that.
Right. Right. Yeah. And that, I wanted to take advantage of their expertise. That was, I know how to write a book. They know how to sell the books. Mm-hmm. And so I really, wanted, and I like it. I liked my original, but I like this one too. And we're going to give it a try.
The suggestions made by the editors mm-hmm. or editor, how did that change the book?
The suggestions by the developmental editor changed the characters. They didn't change the plot. Everything still happens the same way. It's the same as the original ending. So if anyone's read it before, they wouldn't be surprised by anything that's changed. But what she offered were her suggestions to add more context and to deepen the characters' relationships with each other. There's a lot of characters in this book. It's a multiple point of view novel. And because of that, I rotate frequently between them. And hopefully now the reader has a greater understanding of each individual due to the changes that have been made.
And for you as a writer, what was the takeaway of having a development editor?
I really like that. That was one of the pieces when I signed the contract that I was most looking forward to, actually, because while I had editors read it beforehand, I didn't get a lot of input at that higher, you know, 30,000 foot level from someone with a lot of experience in fiction specifically. And I thought, you know, again, it was something that I just didn't have access to on my own. This, the editor developmental editor, was in Texas. Mm-hmm. You know, I couldn't have found her on my own. And so I really liked and appreciated, and as well as the feeling that I had that I was in command. And mm-hmm. had I not agreed with her suggestions, I could have rejected them. So I felt very empowered to look at the feedback offered objectively and decide on my own. And I decided, I'd say 75% of it improved the book.
The opening of your book revolves around a major news story from January of 2009. The novel has three narrative lines which intersect along the way and are pulled together at the end. It's a complex, beautifully written plot. Would you give our listeners a bit of a background on the story?
Sure. Well, the major news incident from January 2009 is popularly known as the Miracle on the Hudson, the plane crash that occurred on the Hudson River after birds struck the plane and everyone was saved, was pulled from the frigid water. My main character is a 12-year-old boy named Robbie who has autism, and he is visiting New York. He's from Michigan, as am I originally, but he is visiting New York with his family, and he's on a sightseeing ferry in the river. The second plot line involves two characters who are passengers, Deborah and Christopher. And Christopher is an ornithologist at Cornell University, and his wife, Deborah, works in fundraising there. And they are having a conflict of their own over whether to have children. And Christopher, later in the novel, turns out to be a kind of a mentor figure to Robbie, who becomes very interested in birds upon learning that birds cause the crash. And the third plot line revolves around a mother and a daughter. The mother is also a witness to the crash. She's on the ferry with Robbie, and her teenage daughter is back home in Pennsylvania watching the news coverage unfold. And the mother has been hiding something from her daughter that is revealed via the TV cameras. And I won't be a complete spoiler, so I won't say what it is. But then all three storylines start there on that day of the crash. And then they go off to their lives. And then, as you say, they intertwine and come back together at the end.
And in the course of the novel, every few pages, you go from one set of characters to another.
Yes.
They just continue on. So these three lines are running throughout the book.
Right.
A real juggling act, which I admire greatly.
Oh, Carrie. Thank you.
Could I get you to read from the story?
Absolutely, yes. And I'll read a little section here that I think is one of the ones that was more transformed by the developmental editor. And the setup here is it is after the crash. The plane is on the river. And as I said, Deborah and Christopher, who were passengers, are awaiting rescue. They're standing on the wings as we speak. It was unreal. A bad dream. It must be. How could a routine takeoff go so wrong in less than 5 minutes? She had had the window seat. Christopher sat beside her on the aisle, engrossed in an ornithology journal even before they were taxied to the runway. The fasten seatbelt signs glowed red. Several rows ahead, a baby cried, innocently flipping on Deborah's internal longing. Then a muffled thud. Then another. Then a third. Then another, and she lost count. Did you hear that? What was that? What's happening out there? Questions, laced more with wonder than fear, floated around her. Christopher lifted his head attentively. Uh-oh, he said, leaning across her to look out the window at the ribbon of river below them. What is it? She asked, the first finger of fright squeezing her stomach as she leaned beside him, her hair swinging forward to brush his cheek. What do you see? Is that smoke? Behind them, a woman's louder, more alarmed voice rose above the murmurs. Smoke? The fright tightened its grip. Christopher's gaze swiveled from the window back into the plane. Deborah followed his eyes. Thin smoke wafted over the seats next to the wing. Simultaneously, she realized the normal takeoff force that pressed her back into the seat was gone. They weren't climbing anymore. For a paralyzed moment, her eyes held Christopher's before he turned to rummage in the seat pocket. We're in trouble. What do you mean? What happened? What's going on? Her voice rose as the plane fell, the fear now a full fist clenching her stomach. They lost the engines. Read this. He shoved the plastic emergency procedures card at her. We're going to need it. We're crashing? Are we going to die? Deborah's voice caught as her hand searched for his. The specialist had said one more try was reasonable. They had to make it home. Christopher shook his head. All I know is it's going to be a rough, wet landing. So with that scene, one of the suggestions the developmental editor made was to have the crash itself have a little more impact. Mm-hmm. And perhaps in the original version, perhaps the characters moved on too quickly, you know, from this very significant traumatic accident. And so with this, I'm trying to bring more sights in the reader's eyes more vividly to the scene. What were they experiencing? You know, the fear, the stunned amazement. How is this possible? And I'm also trying there to show a little bit more closeness between Deborah and Christopher. In the original version, they come out in their polarized positions. She wants a baby. He doesn't. Pretty quickly. And so I try to create a little more tension now mm-hmm. between them.
And another character is Robbie. He's on a ferry crossing the Hudson. He is a spectrum child. His view is very narrow.
Yes. He's on a sightseeing ferry, you know, one of those circle boats that they have around Manhattan. And as in real life, that well, those ferries got pulled into the rescue. You know, they were all diverted, you know, to come to the scene and to the aid of the plane as fast as possible. So yes, he's out there, and it was a very cold January day. So in the book, he's like the only passenger that's even outside. Everybody else is in the cabin, you know, sensibly staying warm. But, you know, Robbie, you know, feels very cloistered in amongst all those people. He likes being by himself. And, you know, and he tends to fixate on things. And in this scene now, they're actually docked at this point. They're still on the ferry, but they're docked. And it's in the aftermath of the crash. On the river side of the ferry, Robbie still hung over the guardrail, glad to have it to himself again, except for his parents. On the dock side, 24 wet passengers were disembarking into a throng of media. Everyone else seemed more interested in them than the plane. Through the binoculars, Robbie scanned the hulk of white metal, wingtip to wingtip. It didn't look menacing at all anymore, the stormtrooper mask tilted half in, half out of the river. I don't see the engines. Are they underwater? Yes, probably, his mom said. Nothing looks broken, not even any windows. So how did the plane crash? He turned the binoculars toward her. Through the lenses, the intersecting lines of her plaid coat looked like little worms on a field of dirt. I don't know how it crashed. I'm sure it will be all over the news, she replied. Was there a fire? Robbie asked. No. How do you know? Well, if there was a fire, it would probably still be going. Or at least we'd smell smoke. Or something. Airplane fires take a long time to put out. Even if you crash on water, wouldn't the water just put it out? Like a campfire? Robbie let the binoculars hang around his neck and mimed dousing a campfire with a bucket. Good question. But no, it wouldn't go out that fast because of all the fuel airplanes carry. It would take a long time to burn off, even sitting in water. Robbie considered it. Then he picked up the binoculars back up and returned his gaze to the plane. Did they get everybody out? I'm sure they did. How do you know? Well, they have lists, you know, passenger lists, that they can check the names of everyone who was rescued against. Lists? Were we on a list when we came here? His mom nodded. There's a special word for it. What is it? Oh, shoot, it's on the tip of my tongue. Huh, cool. Who's got the list? Well, I guess the pilot has it. Then isn't it in the water, too? Well, the airline has a copy, too, on a computer. They can get it to the police and everyone who's responding. Robbie stared out the river again. A circling pigeon screeched. Linda lobbed back answers as fast as Robbie pelted questions. When he finally paused, she called to Sam, who was sitting on a bench up against the cabin. This is amazing. I've never heard him talk so much, ask so many questions. It's been at least 10 rounds. Have you? Sam shook his head. Linda waited for a moment, hoping he'd join them at the railing. Fun family excursion, remember? Robbie was bouncing on his toes, cataloging everything he saw in his stage whisper voice. For once, the headphones were around his neck instead of clapped over his ears. The hood of his Detroit Lions sweatshirt created a pointed silhouette that made him look elfish, more juvenile, though when he was standing straight up instead of leaning over a boat rail, Linda knew that the hood would be past her shoulder. Later, she worried more and more about Robbie's increased inches, which made his autistic behaviors both harder to excuse and more imminently threatening. What would happen when she wasn't, they weren't, there to buffer him from the expectations of the neurotypical world?
Thank you. Carrie Noga, reading from Sparrow Migrations. Carrie, what do you hope that readers will take from this book?
I hope that they will take away a feeling that they can confront and emerge on the other side of whatever obstacles they find in their own lives. When I wrote this book, I wrote the first draft of this book in the 6 months after my own son was diagnosed with autism. And it was very much a therapeutic journey for me to try and work through all the confusion and grief and sadness of those first few months. And, you know, at the time my son was only 5, Robbie's 12. So by making him older, I was able to project, kind of where I hoped it would go and work through a lot of things. The other characters all have relationship conflicts as well, parent, child, husband, wife. And even though the circumstances of whatever a reader is dealing with may be different from what my characters confront, as in special needs or deception, or questions of identity, I hope that they get the impression that these people, that I could emerge triumphant, if you will, and perhaps scarred but wiser on the other side.
And everyone changes in the course of the novel, as they should.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I was just so impressed by this novel the first time I read it, and reading it now in the newest iteration, and for a writer having a chance to come back and look at it again and uh-huh. improve it and grow it must have been spectacular for
yes.
you.
Yeah. It was I'm really pleased with the way it turned out again, and I hope it's going to find a lot more readers now. You, Aaron, when I was here before, you said it's a terrific read that will find a wide and appreciative audience. I remember that, memorized that, and I repeated it to myself more than once when, as I would look at my sales of 3 copies, and it's a terrific read, an appreciative audience. And now I think I'm poised at that moment. So thank you for showing the early confidence.
So what are you working on now? What's next?
I have another novel, my sophomore novel. This is the debut in the works. And this, I was actually cooking along on that one pretty steadily until the revisions for this one came up. So the working title of that one is called Piñata Tears. It has nothing to do with autism, but it is similar in that it's a novel about relationships. And it's set locally. One of the things I learned from Sparrow Migrations is it's difficult to write a book about places you've never been. Most of Sparrow Migrations is not set locally. So I fixed that with the next book, took that lesson to heart. And the primary relationship is between a somewhat middle-aged CSA proprietress, community-supported agriculture proprietress, who's very independent. She's an empty nester. She likes her life the way it is. And she suddenly becomes the guardian to her 9-year-old niece, mm-hmm. who moves from New York City after she's orphaned, where she lived in a very, of course, urban, cosmopolitan, diverse family. She's a daughter of Telemundo executives. And Lucy is none too pleased to have to move to northern Michigan either. And so the two of them are confronted with each other. And bridging the gap between them is a migrant worker named Miguel, who shares some, he can appreciate both of their perspectives, where they come from, and he helps them learn to live together.
Okay, and your book, Sparrow Migrations, will be available throughout the region at independent bookstores and also?
And libraries and on Amazon. And if you don't see it at your favorite bookstore, ask them to order it through Ingram, please.
And listeners can find more about you and your book at?
My website, carrienoga.com. That's CARINOGA.com.
Carrie Noga, thank you so much for being here and congratulations.
Thank you, Aaron. Thanks for having me back. It's been a pleasure.
Fleta Brown is here. Welcome, Fleta.
Hi, Aaron. I'd like to introduce you today to a writer I've known and read for years, although I haven't seen her for years. Her name is Margaret Gibson. Her newest book is Broken Cup from Louisiana State University Press. The poems all come from her watching the progression of her husband David's Alzheimer's disease. David was also a writer and poet. In the epigraph, she describes a Hindu teacher using the cup as metaphor. Over time, it stains, it might chip, but one can still drink from it. Eventually, it cracks, breaks, and no one can use it. The body is like that cup, he said, meaning the body-mind. But whatever you have drunk from the cup over the years, he said, that remains with you. The poems in this volume, as is true of all Gibson's poems, are rooted in daily life. Stones, a garden, the yard, a chair, a dog. I'm sure the word quiet has been used many times to describe her work, but I'd say quiet only in the sense that the poems aren't theatrical. They are so beautifully crafted, so simply said, that we feel we're in the presence of a kind of restraint, the kind that wisdom brings. Many of her poems are written as full sentences on the page, with a space between each one. It's the voice speaking, then considering, then speaking more. Parts one and two of the book are single, long poems, often separated, and this is interesting to me, by a small four-dot square. It's a medieval system, you know, the mathematical system. A is to B, as, C is to D, and the four dots stands for as, which now, of course, we use an equal sign for. Section three intersperses her own writing with passages of her husband's work, another way of making love, she says in the poem. Here's a section from part one, and I'll just pause where the symbol is placed. I grant you, it's terrible to lose one's mind as, burst of light by burst of light, the neurons misfire. Unable to reach across synapses, making run-on sentences, eroded fragments, tangles. In the metaphor of eclipse, the mind is shadowed. No ricochet of radiant protons graces its surface. Where did you grow up, you ask me? My story, you knew it once, yours too. Now you read your memoir, more moved than when you wrote it. The story's fresh, immediate, your depth of feeling no longer held in check by intellect. You read the sentences, your lifelines, amazed. Is it in your DNA, perhaps? A coded sentence. You will, like your mother before you, be asked to let go of all you hold dear. Our friend picks up his paintbrush. You put down your pen. Think of Sisyphus, condemned to accomplish nothing, sentenced to toil uphill to that resting place when the stone crests and settles, tilts and rolls down. What is in his mind at that moment? I keep wanting you to tell me what you remember, what you know and do not know, as the stone rolls, as the river flows, as the root sinks deeper, as is its way out of sight. Eclipsed, the moon goes dark, but the moon is still there, a deep presence held in place, disguised as an eddy in the river. These metaphors, I believe. Up, down, strange, charm, bottom, and top, hums the chorus in the background, as Oedipus, that beautiful man, snow-haired at Colonus, says openly, all is well. And you, who were memory's scribe, this is now what you say. I have been lucky. I have been lucky all my life. So there's a flavor of Margaret Gibson's work, that restrained yet utterly open line and life. The poems feel generous to me. Then in part two of the book, there are more individual poems, each one focused on or triggered by a particular moment. I only have time to read one of these poems. This one is called Losing It. What little I know, I hold more dear now that I take the daily reinvention of loss as my teacher. I will never graduate from this college, whose MA translates Master of Absence, with a subtext in the imperative, misplace anything. If there's anything I want, it's that more people I love join the search party. You were the one renowned among friends for your luck in retrieving from the wayside the perfect bowl for the kitchen, a hand-carved deer, a pencil-drawn portrait of a young girl whose brimming innocence still makes me ache. Now the daily litany of losses goes like this. Do you have your wallet, keys, glasses, gloves, giraffe? Oh, dear, I forgot my giraffe. That's the preferred response. But no, it's usually the glasses, the gloves, the wallet, the keys I've hidden. And when I get frantic, when I've lost my composure, my nerve, my compassion, I have only what little I know to save me. Here's what I know. It's not absence, I fear, but anonymity. I remember taking a deep breath, stopped in my tracks. I'd been looking for an important document I had myself misplaced, high and low. No luck yet. I was beside myself. So there may have indeed been my double running the search party. Stop, you said gently. I'll go get Margaret. She'll know where it is. But I'm Margaret, I gasped. No, no, you held out before me a copy of one of my books, pointing to the author's photograph. You know her, you said. We looked into each other's eyes a long time, the earth tilted on its axis, and what we were looking for, each other and ourselves, took the tilt, and we slid into each other's arms, holding on for dear life, holding on. It's so hard to read that poem. And notice it doesn't pull us by any gratuitous sentiment. It just tells it like it is, with the beautiful music of suffering and loss. This is Gibson's 11th collection of poems. They're very different, but each one has the same delicate lyricism and the same deep connection between our inner and outer selves. She's taught many places, but chiefly at the University of Connecticut. The poet is Margaret Gibson.
Thank you, Flita. Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. I'm grateful to Terry Wooten, Joe Beauchamp, Carrie Noga, and Flita Brown. Also, kudos to Brock Mormon and Peter Payette for their skillful engineering and production work on this show. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen next time to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, I wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.